My only regret about chapter 5, T-Bot, is you mentioning about fucking beef stock in my bolognese.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's 3 pages of my reading life I'm never going to get back, isn't it?
Yeah, that was a little bit longer than I intended. Anyway, let's let's talk about it in situ.
Oh, please, let's recount, let's maybe spend 40 minutes recounting that story.
No, we should.
Yeah, I think we'd gloss over that one. That one.
We definitely should.
That was definitely a one sentence. Guy put stock in the bolognese.
Guy made bolognese. Okay, next. Welcome to the Think It Isn't Until It Is podcast. I'm Finn.
I'm Tim.
I'm Guy.
Chapter 5, Spring 2010 to Autumn 2011, LA and the single-decker tour bus, in which we write, record and tour Perfect Darkness with all the new crew members, tour vehicles and LA studios that entails.
How exciting. It's strange because this almost feels like another band in a way. Like the beginning of Perfect Darkness almost feels like the previous bit was sort of a distinct entity to what happened after 2011. I don't know if anyone else feels like that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting that we wrote Perfect Darkness in essentially kind of the same type of a way. We were in my loft, we were jamming at weekends, we were doing what we do, we were pooling ideas, we were, you know, putting together different tracks and versions, and you know that process was the usual process. But I think when we got the ultimatum that in order to have a different result we needed to do things differently, I think the moment I think the songs we were writing were just more sort of realized at this point. I mean, it's fourth album, but you're right, Timmy, you know, the first three, for me anyway, the first three albums feel like one record.
Yeah,
they're the kind of demo learning curve, you know, think as a band, as me as an individual, trying to find our feet, trying to work out who we are. And then by the end of 2009 we kind of, I don't know, the writing of Perfect Darkness, we had a very much had a band identity.
Yeah,
you know, which we maybe didn't have in the previous records.
Sure. I think partly the sheer amount of touring we did on Sort of Revolution, which, you know, weirdly enough, when you look at Perfect Darkness and Hard Believer, it's kind of dwarfed. but 2009-10, you know, we did a lot of, as we know, splitter travel. And I think we were starting to do things like, I'm very conscious of this sort of moment where you and I sat down with a couple of guitars and played one of our songs in the dressing room, which was Don't Look Down. And for me, I don't know why, but that has a sort of an impact in my mind, because I mean, obviously you'd played with Guy a million times, just the two of you, but that was the first time you and I had done that.
Sure.
And we did that a lot through the Perfect Darkness, you know, a lot of it consists of you and me playing the guitar together, sort of thing. And I think it just opened it up somehow. I don't know.
Well, I just arc back to chapter one, where we got into a rehearsal room and Guy, I think, says that, you know, normally you just go into a room and three people play and that's what you sound like. And hopefully it's Radiohead, you know, in our case certainly wasn't. And I think by the time we got to the writing of Perfect Darkness, we were all starting to arc into each other a lot more. As in, this is what Timmy does, and that's really cool. This is what Finn does, that's really cool. This is what Guy does, that's really cool.
Yeah.
Which enabled us to write songs easier with each other, because we were all more open to each other's kind of, you know, foibles and strengths and weaknesses, which we'd developed over that sort of revolution tour.
Totally, to the point where we're even suggesting what each other should do. Like the beat to Perfect Darkness was a Guy suggestion, for example.
Yeah, and you know, I think also just a sheer amount of equipment. Like in the early days, Tim had a very stripped back kit. By the time we were going to do PD, he was being actively encouraged to get more, buy more cymbals, try more snares, do more stuff, which was the...
Use a tom.
Diametric use opposite. Yeah, use a rack tom. I don't know, where will it end?
Yeah.
Where will it end? Well, the cowbell certainly got lost somewhere in the mix, didn't it?
Yeah.
That wasn't on your kit.
Oh, yeah, cowbell had
darks,
gone.
Was it?
No,
cowbell disappeared.
Fell off. Fell off during distance and time.
Fell off the trailer somewhere. Yeah. Awesome. Thank God for that. But yeah, I mean, I thought the writing of Perfect Darkness was a kind of really nice sort of, I don't know, the songs were getting really good for me and the riffs were getting really good. And moving from my nylon guitar, which was starting to fall apart at this point. Like,
it was literally dying. It was literally
on the last
dying.
Gig of the sort of Revolution tour in Berlin. I remember that the pickup literally just fell out of it on the last strike of All Cried Out or something, whatever we were playing. And that kind of marked the beginning of this, like, Finn plays normal acoustic guitar sort of chapter, which is also a little mark in the sand for our kind of sound.
Yeah. I remember you playing the finger picky style for Yesterday Was Hard on All of Us on your, I think it was on your dad's Martin, when you were just writing it, and you said to me, oh, you know, I've been mucking around with this. I think you were listening to a particular guitarist who did that kind of style. And you said, this is,
I don't know who I was listening to. Maybe, well, a lot of Jose, obviously. I always get inspired by listening to a bit of Jose, and also a lot of the kind of folky finger pickers like Nick Drake and Dick Gocken and people like that.
I think it was Dick Gocken, actually. I remember you mentioning him.
Yeah. But it was in normal tuning, which was kind of interesting, because I was leaning super heavy on this drop D tuning on the nylon. Mm. And then we wrote Berlin Sunrise and Yesterday Was Hard on All of Us and Warm Shadow all in normal tuning, because I wanted a bit more gravitas to my chordal vibes. And also we played Fear Is Like Fire.
Yeah.
Eventually, it was also normal tuning, because it just enabled us all to contribute more, because it wasn't so vague. It was much more defined.
Yeah.
As in, the chorus of Berlin Sunrise has a big F, and then it has a big, you know, G, and, you know, it has a big C. And it's not kind of vaguey, open tuney type chords. It's much more like 2 feet on the ground.
I seem to remember, I think you tried to ban D, because you'd already always played anything in Dadgad. I think you said, right, this record, I want nothing in D. So we didn't quite manage it, but yeah, Fear Is Like Fire is in E, and Berlin Sunrise is in F. You managed it, and I think that did change the sound and the approach as well.
It's true, because when we were playing the sort of Revolution tour, it was just a realization that actually I could play most of this set without needing to tune my guitar, like, or have even put a capo on. It was like everything was in D.
I remember that you always used to say when I was nervous in the early days, you were like, if in doubt, just go for D, bro.
Yeah.
the odds are you'll be right.
Absolutely. I mean, it's kind of, I suppose the biggest difference with this period in time was, rather than trek up to my loft and bosh out a free record to recoup, we had the option of, let's go record a record with a, I mean, on Distance and Time, we worked with Andy Barlow, which was great and a really great experience. But this was a much more kind of grown up studio experience, as in, you're going to fly someone, big time producer, fancy studio, not in the UK, stuff of dreams, isn't it, basically?
So what
LA, baby.
I'm trying to think at what point that became the plan, because in my memory, we'd written a bunch of stuff, then LA became the plan, then we finished off the stuff. So it was sort of like, okay, this is what we're going for now, so let's spend the summer kind of locking this in.
I think that it was a combination of things, from my memory anyway, which is pretty patchy from this time, but it was a combination of Summit management being like, we need it to sound different.
Yeah. You know,
we need it to be different. And I didn't want to produce sort of Revolution. I wanted, we went through lots of different options for that one, and no one just stepped up to it. So
yeah,
I think Summit was like, okay, I might have actually found someone who just produced one of his indie bands, Boxer Rebellion, and had a really great experience with Billy. And he was just kind of like, this guy, if he's into it and gives us a discount, then it might be doable. And the real deal breaker was when we did the budgets. It was like, if we record it in London and he flies over, it'll cost X. If we do it in LA and we go to him, it's actually even cheaper than doing that.
Yeah. That was a real eye-opener to me. I had no idea that would be the case.
Isn't that nuts?
That was amazing.
Is that literally down to the cost of studios and the rarity, scarcety of studios?
It was everything. It was like flying Billy over with all of his gear was more expensive than us flying over there with all of our gear.
Sure.
Yeah.
And the scarcity of good studios in the UK would mean we'd have to go residential somewhere or be in London.
Yeah.
And London is like, forget it, you know? And so it all tapped into this sort of ideology of like, okay, this album, whatever it's going to be, is going to be different on every level, including where we play it, how we record it, how it's done, how it's everything. And as soon as we knew we were going to Los Angeles to record with Billy, I think it also made our songwriting just clenched our buttocks a little as songwriters to go, okay, yeah. We don't want to rock up with some half-baked bullshit. We want to like actually rock up with a, this might be a single. This is a deep album cut. This is, and with the bandwidth of, oh, we haven't finished this one yet, but Don't Tell Ninja Tune.
Right.
Because Billy was okay with that. Do you remember? We had a really cool Skype call with him.
Yes.
And
yes,
we didn't have enough tracks. We only had 8 tracks. Some of them weren't finished, which became a recurring theme moving forward for our album recording. Mm. Billy was up for that challenge, as well as the suicidal challenge of, okay, you've got like 14 days to record and essentially mix a proper record, which is a real, as he said to us on that call, you know, if you guys are rehearsed and totally on point and there's no shenanigans and no like, you know, band dysfunctional bullshit that gets in the way, this is doable. But if you're not, then it's just going to be a really expensive train wreck.
Well, he also said something that hadn't occurred to me, because I must say, when the LA plan came into you know, the picture, I was very sort of doubtful and weird about it, partly because of the expense, and that was, you know, sorted after a while, but also it was such an unknown. You know, this is what I mean about it almost feeling like a kind of new, because we'd got used to everything we were doing before. We got used to being in a splitter. We got used to recording and so on in your loft. And then suddenly it was this, oh my God, we're going to this completely new place. And what's it going to be like? Do we need to take all our gear? I mean, funnily enough, you know, we didn't really need, I mean, I barely needed to take a pair of drumsticks in the end, but I didn't know that. I thought that I was going to have to take all my shit that I use in England. And but Billy also said something in that Skype call, which was, you've got to understand that you will be away from everything. You will be on the other side of the world. You will be only there to do this. And that is going to give you a lot of extra mental bandwidth.
Yeah, no,
and he totally was completely right. I mean, Guy, I think you put it perfectly in the book, that you work better when you're half a planet away from your planet.
Absolutely. Wake up and say goodnight. I mean, just to skip forward about 50 chapters to a recent recording, compare and contrast. Do you remember I was driving myself home from a recording session when we were doing the Resurgam, and I crashed my car. Do you remember?
I went into
the back of another car. So there you go. Case in point, it was impossible for me to crash my own car when I'm in LA.
Yeah,
so
sure.
No day spent on the phone to insurance companies or any of that bollocks. Mind you could have crashed. You were driving, weren't you, T? So I can enjoy the driving, the luxury of being chauffeured around.
My
by
driving
you guys.
Is improved.
What, you've got slower.
Less aggressive. He's got a bit less aggressive.
I'm slower, I'm much slower now.
I'm in no position to moan. I mean, I used to moan, and I remember you telling me often, and quite rightly saying, dude, you're not really in a position to moan when you don't have a driving license. Mm-hmm. It's a fair point. So I quit my moaning on that one.
I tell you, the main difference with Perfect Darkness was the approach was similar to the distance and time approach, but with the added bonus of the glory and the glamour, the faded glamour of the whole Los Angeles gig, because we had to pre-write everything, pre-load ourselves, and then go in there and just get it out. And there wasn't the room or the time to overthink stuff, which when you're recording in your own loft over a 5-month period of gently getting it done bit by bit, you can think like way too much, and you can bin some great ideas.
Sure.
And it was also really good to have, you know, a producer where me in particular, but also I suppose you guys too, when you say to someone, is that good enough? Not artistically, not creatively, but like technically, you know, is that guitar take clean enough? You had someone else to say, yep, or no, let's do another take. And that saved days and days and days of time. And and Billy, just his technique of setting everything up in advance and then just belt it out as fast as you can was such a great technique, man. We got so many really live kind of moments on that Perfect Darkness record. To this day, I think that's why it created so many new fans for us and moved the needle for us so much, because it was such an honest reflection of what we were at that point without any filter at all. I mean, it was essentially a live record,
yes,
basically, in the studio.
It is, actually. I mean, it's a very different record to... Because I tend to sort of sometimes bracket it together with Hard Believer, but it's a very different record to Hard Believer. It's much more live, and it's much more... It's actually much more basic in a way. It still sounds like an acoustic trio with additional oomph, you know?
Don't Google that synth. It doesn't exist. The oomph synth is still in development.
I know.
It's a good name.
But it has more, it's got stuff to hang stuff on, like additional melodies going on, counterpoint melodies, counterpoint rhythms, and all of that sort of stuff is in there, kind of, for one of the first times, at least.
Yeah.
You know.
I remember Steakhouse so clearly. I really do like just the feeling of the big doors and the wooden floors. And it was our first proper studio, really, and it was just kind of like, dude, this is it. I mean, it just the live room was amazing, and just everything about it was so grown up and real. It was so cool,
and everybody there was lovely.
I
really enjoyed as well the aspect of cramming the three of us into a little two-bedroom apartment in Coakwood. So in, you know, immediately you walk in, it's like we're in this little compressed environment, whereas if we were recording the previous records, you know, sort of one bit at a time, I can drift off home, Tim will drift off home, and you're working on it by yourself to a degree. When we were in Coakwood, we come home every night from our day's recording, and the three of us are sat there, and what are we going to discuss other than what we've done all day, where our victories were, where we were worried, where we thought things might fall down. And it really helped to focus all of our minds on the same. Whenever we went to bed, we didn't go to bed in any arguments. We all went to bed all knowing what we wanted to do the next morning, you know? And I think that cuts through so much bullshit. I don't think we could have got a record done in 14 days if it wasn't for that. I think if we'd all been staying in separate places, we might not have made it. I think that compressed living in each other's laps really helped as well. I think there was nowhere for any of us to hide. You know, if I was feeling grouchy, or, you know, you were feeling particularly elated, you know, you can see it. We can all feed off it. And it was crucial.
And, you know, following in some amazing footsteps with Coakwood as well, because several bands have stayed there. Right. Nirvana stayed there when they were doing Nevermind.
Oh, man, like,
you know, I didn't know any of this. I didn't know, as ever with me, until I read the book, I didn't know anything about this.
Every transient band has stayed there. I mean, I'm sure if they'd kept a list of bands that have stayed there, it would contain like every name you can imagine. I mean, it's just it's the temporary community LA spot, isn't it? Basically, Oakwood apartments. I mean,
I remember it so well. I remember like the weather, like it being, you know, that slightly little chill in the air, but really sunny that LA gets in the winter.
Yeah,
I can remember that. I can remember the those crazy tire shredding things that we had to drive over every day. You know, the ones that you can't reverse back.
Oh, God, it was so scary, dude. It was like, dude.
All that stuff.
Yeah, it was so scary.
I know. And then wandering around the area, you know, the area where Steakhouse is, because it's very sleepy around there. It's not like...
Yeah, is it Magnolia?
Magnolia, right. It's not Hollywood Central. It's the valley. So it's a little kind of Mexican deli next door where Guy got his... Mexican Coke, which has what, four times the amount of sugar in or something, guys?
Something like, I didn't know. I was drinking it and getting well and truly buzzed up, and then it was one of the guys in the studio, I think it was June, said, damn, you're drinking the Mexican Cola. And I was like, oh, I didn't know there was a difference. He's like, oh, there's a difference, all right, mate. If you weren't diabetic before, you probably are now. It's lovely stuff.
Yeah, it was good, man. I mean, classic. I think that was before I was really into diet and stuff. We were just rolling with it at that point, where we didn't really need to think about diet and
low
carbs
mess
and all that.
It was just for lunch, you know.
It was just whatever kept us going, and I think I was on such a high from just being there and doing it that I didn't really actually need. I don't remember feeling tired or stressed or exhausted at all.
No, not at all.
For me, it was, you know, it's sort of. It helped to boost your confidence on day one of setting up. The very first kick drum you hear coming through the speakers, I think a drum would be the first thing we heard. And the minute the mics are literally set live for the first time, you hear a thump through those speakers, I thought, okay, sonically, I'm already happy. I know this is going to go well. And as you said, Finn, the songs were strong. I mean, we might have been slightly slightly deceptive to everybody about how much material we had and how ready it was to go.
Yeah, true.
But one of my fondest memories of it was Wheels, because you kept us all in the dark a little bit. Yeah, I mean, as you know, we knew you had a blues track. We knew it was about skateboarding. That was about the size of it. And I remember you built up to this moment, Finn, and you took me aside and said, okay, I want to get right deep into the zone for this one. I really want to do it in one take, if possible, warts and all. I just want to do it.
We probably had a joint outside, didn't we? We must have had a smoke before.
Yeah, well, you demanded one. You said, right, so, okay, guy, roll a really nice joint. And we smoked it, and then you went in. And so when it says in the book that this is the absolute recording as it happened, that's not absolutely true, because it was about 30 seconds before that recording starts where you started the riff, got yourself a little bit confused, fell off and went, okay, I'm kind of regretting that joint with Guy now. and then you start the tune, which is right. The live recording we've got on there. And I begged Billy to keep that on there.
Actually, I kind of think I actually kind of remember that moment.
I really wanted to keep it on there.
It reminds me of the early days when we were touring, especially that gig in Rotund in Belgium where we did a duo.
Oh,
gig.
Yeah.
And Samar had given me some Thai sticks, some Thai weed from Paris. And we thought it was really, like, really chilled. And I said to you, dude, be careful, it's deceptive. And we hit that stage. Completely blitzed out. It's a terrifying show. But yeah, I mean, you know, when you're in a studio, it's okay because you're in this beautiful, closeted, cushioned environment. It's like you're in a padded cell. You can't possibly hurt yourself musically
right.
in there.
Yeah.
So, and all I had to do that whole day was Wheels. So, I mean, I'm sure while I was gearing myself up, Timmy was overdubbing something on something and Guy was working on a riff for something and Timmy was working on a guitar line for something. But all I had to do that day was... it was play a riff and sing a song. So which it was, Wheels was specifically designed as an experiment to be that first time you ever play it, to capture that vibe, that first time.
Yeah.
That first time vibe. So half of my energy in during the take was, you know, that live feeling of have survived the take intact. Don't take too many risks. Don't don't stick your neck out too much because you want this. You don't want it to be like, oh, this really captures the seventh take. I did.
Right,
you know,
right.
You want it to be that first take.
And that's significant as well, isn't it? I mean, that freshness is really, really audible.
Oh, it's crucial. You know? It's part of the character.
It's way too fast as well. You know, hearing it now on the record, I think, dude, just take it easy. Just slow down a little bit. Yeah, definitely the heart rate was up. I mean, I don't think it was clicked or anything.
It wasn't clicked, mate. I actually remember it very, very clearly. And I can tell you actually, mate, Tim was not off working on a riff, and neither was I. It was, you had everybody's undivided attention. You must have felt a bit under a spotlight because you did go, right, I'm going to do this blues track now. And you walked in and we'd all been waiting to hear what was going to happen. And so you had a control room of people stood there. I imagine Billy might have looked ever so slightly nervous, maybe. But so you went into the booth, mate, and you did have... you had the whole weight of the world on your shoulders for that one, and like I say, you were pretty baked. So you just went, right, I'm just going to dive in, and I think it really worked, man. It really, as we say, it went on to become the name of an actual live album. It's a staple. I mean, I want to do Wheels every time we play. We've played it with other musicians. It's that track has gone on to do great things, man.
Gained stuff as well. It's almost like we carried on writing it after you'd
True.
Recorded it.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It gained chords. It gained a chord progression.
Oh, yes.
Gained loads, yeah, over the touring period. And yeah, I was really inspired by, you know, John Lee Hooker on that one, just because I was really obsessed by this album, That's My Story, where he would just basically be jamming his own story. And I just thought, look, it's okay to record a jam. Maybe that was the beginning of me letting go a little bit, which enabled the music to get a lot better.
Yeah.
Maybe
yeah.
That one track, that one moment. But
sure.
When we were mixing down at the very end of the sesh, and Berlin Sunrise needed to have a complete overhaul because we'd recorded it and it had come out sounding a bit like the Scissor Sisters. and we were like, okay, yeah, maybe disco's not really... We do many different styles, and maybe that's our criticism sometimes, but disco's not something we're going to go to. So
yeah. Yeah.
That
it's
was
one
a really
of those
weird vibe.
It was, wasn't it? I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, when you go into, say, do you remember when we played San Siro Stadium? We supported Negromara at San Siro.
Mm.
And you've got this absolutely enormous stadium. And I walk on with my single kick drum and Guy walks on in with his acoustic bass. And you look at it and you just think, fucking, there's no way that this is going to
translate,
cut the mustard in this huge place. Sometimes it's a bit like that when you bring a demo that you've done in your home setup and you go into a place like Steakhouse or Assault and Battery,
yeah,
and you try and do what you did there, and it just doesn't cut it. And it happened. It's happened to us a couple of times over the years, but that Berlin Sunrise was a particular example where the demo, I think it worked so well at demo level because it was kind of deliberately lo-fi. But then when we tried to play it in this amazing Steakhouse studio with this amazing producer and so forth, it was just like, okay,
yeah,
the cracks are visible.
There's nowhere to hide.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a common problem with chasing the demo, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's chasing the DIY nature of the demo in a very un-DIY space.
Yeah.
And when you listen to a phone recording, you're like listening to its potential. But when you're in the studio, you're not listening to its potential anymore. You're listening to it.
Yeah.
So it's like, okay.
You can hear that it's a facsimile of an idea rather than the idea. And, you know, for me, actually, if you compare your mindset, Finn, when we were doing Biscuits for Breakfast, and I told you, if me and Tim had told you at that time that fast forward X number of years, you are going to actively want to jam a blues track and plan on that being going onto the record as is, you would have told us we had lost our minds.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, a lot had changed in those preceding 4 years. A lot of lessons have been learnt about music and live music and band related music. You know, it's I definitely lost my sort of the outfit I was wearing when we started the band, which was like a 90s bedroom producer trying to work out what to do next in the early noughties, and I'd become much more of like we're a band, we go in the studio, we record the songs, we put them out, and hopefully everybody likes them when we do loads of gigs, which is a totally different outfit, you know?
Yeah, sure, it is. I just want to talk about one thing before we move on, which is the
Bolognese.
Which is going to sound.
Is it now the fascinating Bolognese story?
We'll leave the Bolognese to the book, maybe.
Oh,
but what I do want to just mention, and this is going to sound flippant, but I assure you it is not, is that upstairs from the studio in Steakhouse was a table tennis room.
There's less than a minute to go on the Zoom. We haven't got time to cover how fucking awesome I am, bro.
But what the thing is that it was absolutely brilliant having that room upstairs because whatever we'd done a load of stuff with Billy. We'd done a load of bits and bobs, and he'd said to us, "Okay, guys, I'm just going to put this together." So, you know, take a 15-minute break or whatever.
I can just translate that in producer speak to, okay, guys, I'd really like it if you all just fuck off now and give me 15 minutes to myself.
Yeah, stop your constant bickering.
Absolutely.
So we went upstairs to the place where, and there's something amazing about all knowing, right, we're all going to go upstairs to the same place. Maybe we're going to put some other music on and we're going to play a game. And that is just brilliant. And studios that don't have that, I mean, I almost would say, you know, that's a reason to book a studio. Has it got a chill out room? Has it got a space with something completely different to do?
Absolutely necessary.
All sitting around watching CNN is not the same, is it? It just leads to politics. You go and watch telly and you come back to record your part angry. I don't understand studios that have CNN rolling in the background.
Or standing around in the car park outside on the phone or something. It's just not the same.
Let's talk about Ninja's reactions, the label's reactions to the demos of Perfect Darkness, because it was different for them, because they'd spent, well, I mean, I say they, I mean, we ultimately, of course, I mean, but money had been spent on this one that hadn't been spent on others.
Yeah.
So I think Perfect Darkness came in at like 25 grand or something, maybe 20 grand, something like that, which was a significant investment for Ninja and us at that time.
Mm.
So I think Ninja Tune were, like, I'd say relieved that it sounded different than the previous records. They were super relieved about that. And they especially liked the fact that we'd put strings on the track Perfect Darkness. They thought that worked really, really great. And that we were kind of developing, we're moving forward. And that tapped really into Sumit's idea of, like, everything's going to be different. So that includes writing the record, recording the record, and then touring the record.
Yeah,
which is
going
to be, it's not going to be you three guys in a splitter playing every toilet in Europe. It's going to be, well, you three guys and a light rig And a bus touring every toilet in Europe. So it's like, okay.
Let's jazz club in Poland.
Love that. So, yeah, we the tour was booked pretty soon after we were in the mix, wasn't it? And
yeah.
Yes, there was a bus involved, which was very exciting. But the first couple of weeks was very much business as usual. We were in a couple of splitters. Let's talk about our lighting scenario. The birth of Lamposaurus.
Birth of Lamposaurus. I don't know how Summit got in touch with them, but we ended up having a meeting with these guys, 59 Productions. And I remember sitting in Soho Square with you, Finn.
Yeah, I remember that, really. Yeah, Golden Square, yeah.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah.
And then just having a meeting and talking about what we could do in order to make... And there was this idea about us not getting additional musicians, which we could have done at that point, probably. But having the production being, in a way, the fourth member of the band. So we could do what we... Essentially do what we usually did.
Well, that was the thing, wasn't it? It was like, look, you know, we're not suddenly overnight going to turn into, you know, the Foo Fighters, all right? So I'm sat down, Guy sat down, because I'm sat down, and Timmy sat down. And it would be great if the stage could do some of the heavy lifting for us. 59, they were awesome. I mean, again, it was a massive investment for us. The first round of that tour basically just paid for them.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure of that.
Yeah,
but it was like... I think they repurposed a theatre show that they had knocking about.
Okay.
Or they repurposed the pitch for a theatre idea. So our stage was very much like a theatre set with this light rig that kind of arced around.
Yes.
Custom built, but could also be broken down and modulated into a trailer, which was like brilliant.
It was,
you know,
insane,
because
wasn't it? Incredible idea.
From the audience, it looked really slick, but when you got up close to it, you could see the welds, you know,
and the
bolts that you had to screw into it to make it stand up straight. But most importantly, of course, it was all made from IKEA parts, so that if any part went down at any moment, all you had to do was get in a van to IKEA and go and buy 60 angle poise lamps at €6 a go,
and the bulbs you're back as in well. Business. I mean, the bulbs were,
and the bulbs, of course.
Yeah.
But so we got that. They also made custom made films for each track, and we had these kind of like muslin sort of screens that we had to set up every night in a kind of reverse arc. And then, and we had Argy.
And
it was our first meeting of Argy, who became our loyal, you know, all things light related for almost a decade after that, which was just brilliant.
Can you remember meeting Argy for the first time?
I absolutely can. I can.
Oh, yeah. Geez, do I remember? I just managed to get some weed for going on tour, and he walked up and asked me if I had any. I gave him a quarter, thinking, okay, that should get us through about a week. And about 20 minutes later, he came back to me and said, "You haven't got any more." Oh my God. But actually, with the 59 Productions thing, they were absolutely brilliant, and I'm not dissing them, but here's the one thing that they didn't know was what touring entails. And RG actually, I think, gave him a bit of a wake-up call on that one, because when we went to do the first production rehearsals, do you remember Lamposaurus turned up in an absolute, like, the entire thing contained within just one giant monolithic wooden box on a set of Cars to Wheels. Do you remember? And RG looked at it and just went, "Well, that's not happening, guys." And none of us sort of knew why. We were like, "Why?" And he said, "Well, because it's in a box that weighs a ton and a half. How are you going to get that in and out of venues?" He's like, "Nah, the box is going. Everything has to just come out. We've got to figure out a different solution."
Yeah.
And luckily we did. But and I remember seeing that giant wooden box and thinking, "Oh,
well, I mean,
God."
Look, you know, 59 Productions, you know, they had never really dealt with a band of our level,
touring,
let's say.
Exactly.
And by our level, I mean so little.
Small.
Yeah. So exactly. I think they were assuming, well, you just get the forklift truck to lift it on.
Yeah, forklift,
stage,
just put it on the truck. Exactly.
Go, yeah, when we play Rome and we get all of the stage hands to carry it down three flights of stairs.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's going to be Herculean. So
it was easier in bits.
But I mean, it was amazing that it survived. Yeah. I mean, it survives to this day. I've got bits of it in my storage that I'm waiting to make into some kind of installation when I get the space to do it. But
RG had to become something of a surgeon. I mean, every day he was operating on different bits of it as the tour went on. The longer it went the more beaten up everything became.
But it was great though, because RG is a tour beast. He's a live music animal, and 59 Productions is maybe more theatrical. And it was really good that these two worlds collided, because they did meet.
They
in
really
the
did.
We wanted theatre.
It was wonderful.
And we wanted light. We wanted tourability, and we got it from the two of them. The first gig of that run St. Stephen's Church in Brighton,
yeah,
was when Argy showed up and he immediately forgot his ladder and his toolbox in the venue. Like the next day, we were like touring with the lighting guy with like no gear anymore because he'd left it in the venue, which I thought was just great because we were all in the same boat, you know?
Sure. I remember the next day after that Brighton gig, I had to drive up to Nottingham because I was on that first bit of the tour. I was driving a van with all the gear. And Finn, you were driving a people carrier. And I was driving with Argy up to Nottingham. And honestly, he just didn't shut up for the entire trip. And I mean, now I'm used to him. Now I'm used to him. I can sort of ride it, you know. But on that first day, I was just thinking, oh my God, I've got to have 2 months of this. What am I going to do?
Bless him.
But I also, I like the fact that, Guy, you said that we had to think of a different solution for carrying the Lamposaurus around. The solution was we just get it all out of the box and put it into the trailer individually.
Yeah. Bin the box.
So everyone carried a bit of that metal framing.
I mean, I loved how robust it was and how when we would set up the stage with this gear, it would suddenly be our stage.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't matter who played last night or who played tomorrow night. Tonight, this is our stage. And look, we've even made it like our stage. Yeah. We've dressed it. And no matter what happens on stage when we do the gig, the audience that's going to see it are going to see something they're not going to see from anyone else. Yeah. And that gave me loads of really nice, silent, soft confidence for the show.
Sure.
Yeah. It's like, this is a show on two levels. Yes, it's a bunch of guys playing songs. But on another level, wow, it looks really cool. Mm. And you're going to definitely like remember that.
We'd never had that before either.
Never had that before. We would always been so basic before. Mm. So.
Yeah, very true.
And of course, the idea of having a trailer on a bus also means you can bring more gear. So I could bring 4 guitars. Guy could bring 3 guitars. You know, Timmy could bring all kinds of stuff. It was brilliant.
I could bring an amp.
You know?
And...
Yeah, we could bring whatever we wanted. You could bring I made a pedal board for the first time, you know?
Sure.
It's just great, really great and exciting times.
Yeah, it was very exciting. And also just in the book, I think we talk about how very few bands probably hold off so long to use a tour bus.
Sure.
But I'm really pleased that we did because it's almost like we were able to appreciate each rung of the ladder a bit more.
And we had a merch seller, of course, who was amazing, Moines. And we had Rich Keeling as tour manager, which was amazing because we needed it. And again, in Summit's mantra of doing things differently, it was like we needed a tour manager so Timmy didn't have to go and collect the money from the promoter after the show, and I didn't have to, you know, do the merch calculation at the end of the day because we're busy, you know, trying to be rock stars, you know? So it's not like we would leave the stage and like shoot up and hang out with hookers or anything, but it was just like, you know, we needed to come down after a show. We needed to prepare for a show. We didn't have time to lay the merch stall out or, you know, find mandolin strings in Austin, you know?
In Austin. I've got so many good memories from that tour, that first tour, just the sort of iciness of some of the places where we went to for the first time, you know, going to Dornburn.
Was the Perfect Darkness tour where we parked the bus next to a rave in the Czech Republic and
yes,
it ran out of juice?
It was.
Oh, because me and Guy were wandering around wasn't that bonkers?
Yeah, that was in
Bratislava. To get into this illegal rave, the guys, my memory tells me that the guys on the door were like balaclava wearing, Kalashnikov holding gangsters.
They did, they
and
had...
we all got in.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was the weirdest thing
it
ever.
Was,
and then
we
came back to the bus and it was so cold that the air had like ice in the air, floating in the air.
Yeah.
And we got back to the bus and there was no power because the promoters had just simply unplugged
just
it to plug in their rails.
Yeah, just pulled the plug, exactly.
And
right.
that's what did for us, isn't it? That's why the bus broke down. Am I right in saying that? It was the alternator, wasn't it?
I think there might have been more than one bus error, but yeah, the alternator that you're talking about.
Do you
remember we were in Prague and they sourced one, I think in Germany or Austria.
Austria.
Yeah, and they put it in a taxi and the taxi drove it across several countries to bring it to us.
At vast expense.
Well, the cab cost was luckily not to be borne by us, but yeah, that cab cost must have been eye-watering.
Yeah.
And we spent the night in the venue.
I remember also going to Batch Cap.
Ah, the old
for the first
Batch Cap
time.
In Frankfurt.
Batch Cap in Frankfurt.
Oh,
the old Batch Cap.
Place.
And it was all lovely and amazing, but it was absolutely freezing by this point. And Batch Cap happened to be the venue at which the box of Irie Daily clothing arrived, because you've got a really good mate at Irie Daily, right?
Oh yeah, my really dear friend Denise had said to us, hey man, you know, we've got this German label and if you want to have a little supermarket sweep. And at the time that kind of skatery, cheeky thing was definitely in our wheelhouse.
Yeah.
So in fact, Guy's wearing an Irie Daily hoodie right now. So we did get a big bot. We got a big care parcel in Frankfurt.
Yeah.
That's right.
It was amazing. But the funny thing was, it was so cold that I think I put on like everything I'd ordered.
This is the tour when we discovered the benevolence of Finn handing out socks.
The sock benevolence. Be careful. Don't look at, behind every gift is an ulterior motive.
I work on the assumption, every tour we go on now, I work on the assumption that at some point Finn will give me some socks because he will not have come with enough.
I think that it wasn't this tour that I bought the socks in a Romanian military store, but that's a story for another chapter. That was really extreme. But one of my obviously we remember lots of things from this tour, including getting locked in an abattoir in Prague because we didn't have a bus anymore and stuff like this.
Yeah.
And flying to where did we fly to in cash?
Warsaw.
Yeah. That's right. So with the bus broke down, we stayed in the venue. We were waiting all night for an update, and the update came in the morning, along with the local police being like, "What are you all doing locked into this venue?" I think Guy had literally just skinned up on a flight case when he banged on the door, and he literally kind of fainted on the spot.
Yeah, I nearly died. But, on the spot. Yeah.
And the gig was the bus isn't coming. Sorry, the alternator is being driven from Austria. It'll take 24 hours. So Rich gave us an envelope of cash. We got a taxi to the airport with a guitar each. And I remember my memory of that airport was like not only going to it was really like a movie of like three guys looking a bit ragged, having slept on a bench that night, turning up going like, yes, three one-way tickets to Warsaw, please. Here's an envelope of cash. It just felt like a spy movie. It was brilliant.
Yeah, it was.
I thought to myself, I really want like a little sugar boost. And we went to a little shop in the airport to buy a chocolate bar. And I thought I was buying a bounty, but it turns out that in the Czech Republic, things that look like bounties actually have an extremely high rum content, even in the sweets. So I had this bounty bar and I was like, wasted.
We shared it. I had some. It was the worst thing we could possibly have eaten. We were sleepy enough.
I couldn't believe it. And then Rachel Samani, bless her to this day, she was like, well, I'm not going to be left out. I'm going to join you too. So she got a little envelope of her merch money and a guitar
and met us at the
airport and was like, I'm coming along for the ride.
Yeah, that was so lovely.
That is strangely one of my favorite gigs of that tour. And I think it's a case of one of those instances where adversity really brings out the best in you, because you were fucking furious, Finn, because we'd done this 59 production stage set, and like you said, the stage was doing
It was a big gig because Poland was one of our early international adopters. We'd put a lot of time and effort into Poland, all the way from Katowice and every place we played in Poland.
And it got a venue upgrade.
And we got a venue upgrade because the ticket sales were great. And it was like, this is one of the biggest shows of the tour. And it was going to be basically us rocking up on higher gear.
But I think the thing that helped was that because we felt so begrudging of the way fate had dealt us this horrible, horrible hand. I think maybe, not that we didn't put everything into every other show, but maybe we gave 110% that show because we had nothing else to do. But I've only got one bass. I've got one bass. You've got one Martin. Tim's got probably hired drum kit and his telly. That's it. So what are we going to do? The only thing we could do was literally dig so deep. And then you really cutely said to the audience, Finn, it was one of your best speeches to an audience that I can remember. You stopped between tracks and you said, look, okay, obviously everybody's aware of the situation. So I've gone out on all the socials. Our bus is stuck back in the Czech Republic along with our actual stage show. And everyone in the audience went, boo, nicely, boo. And you were like, I'm really sorry.
We're really sorry. I think they're always nicely booing every time they boo me.
But do you remember you said, look, we feel so bad about it for you guys that everyone who's at this gig can send us a message via the MySpace or whatever and quote the following code word. And I think you said code word is alternator. And anyone who emails us and quotes the word alternator, we will burn you a CD of rare demos, unreleased stuff, and we'll put it in the post.
I did do that. Bloody hell. Have you got a copy of that CD?
I wish I did, mate. I didn't get one, but the audience went absolutely apeshit. Mate, the love. I think that might be part of why the love in Poland still continues this day. I think it was so nice of you to do that, and you did it. You went home. And the funny thing was, I think we had like, I don't know, let's say a number, 400, 500 people in the room. I think you received about 1,200 emails saying alternator.
I definitely got a lot of bloody emails on the MySpace.
I remember you announcing, once we reach 600, that's it. no
that's
more.
It. I also remember waiting for the pizza to arrive because I was absolutely bloody starving and there was no rider food, nothing, there was nothing there. And the promoter was the kind of usual kind of, hey man, don't worry, you'll have a big meal after the show. And it was like, dude, I slept on a bench last night in an abattoir. I need to eat something before the show. And he was like, yeah, the pizzas will be here in 5 minutes. Yeah, 5 minutes. Yeah, 10 minutes. Yeah, oh, 20 minutes. And then we were on. And I think Rachel might have even brought me a slice on stage.
She did. And also, I think when she went on stage, she came on and she said, the pizzas have just arrived backstage. I hope you realise what a sacrifice I'm making.
Lovely Rachel Samani. Touring with her was such a beautiful thing because even though she was only just 18 on that tour.
Oh my God, I can't believe that.
Man, every night she was flawless. And I mean, we've had such a great run. I mean, I remember Charlene Soraya from the early run of that tour, mainly her dungarees and her whistle singing.
But, and her swearing on stage.
She had a mouth like a trucker. There's no doubt about that. It was pretty. We had to have a word with her at one point just to sort of say, look, you know, our audiences are really into music. They're not really into this, you know, volume of profanity. I mean, it's
well, there were seated venues as well. But then
I saw Adele do Glastonbury, I was like, oh right, maybe that's what it is. I don't know.
Probably. Well, did she swear a lot?
Yeah. Charlene Soraya was great, but it was really abstract because she had just done a cover of some big track that had gone into the top five in the UK. So it had been used for a John Lewis ad or a Tetley T ad or something. So she was actually mega famous when we were doing our run. It was kind of weird, but. Luckily, Rachel wasn't. So she would come on every night and she would come on every night and just be flawless.
Oh, yeah, she was amazing.
And unique. Mm-hmm. And she still is, actually. I mean, she still is. I just produced her latest EP. It was such a joy. She's one of the greatest songwriters I think we've got.
And just a positive human being.
And she wasn't shy of getting involved with Lamposaurus at
all. No.
I mean, all
heavy
of us.
Heavy lifting, yeah.
Load that out of the truck every night, gloves on, you know, and just and build it and rig it. And, you know, there were cuts and injuries and niggles. And you know, and it was just we were all such a great big team, and no diva policy, which was really, really fantastic because I think that then spreads to your crew. I'm not saying crews are divas at all, but you know, now I realize it's quite a big ask to say, you know, to the sound guy and the lighting guy, can you help lug all the gear to the stage? You think, no, your job's lights and your job's front of house, and my job is, you know, but back then we were just everybody was equal. It was a beautiful thing, that tour.
Yeah. Really, really. And Rachel's positive influence over us. I mean, honestly, you know, as you guys are well aware, and our audience probably not so much, I can be quite a grumpy, insular character.
Really?
Really?
Yeah. I remember being sat on a bus. I remember being sat on a bus once, and I think we were just sat in traffic. It's literally something as simple as, here we are, in traffic, we're late for our loading.
That's a classic guy trigger.
Yeah, and there's me.
As in, the bus
going,
is going slightly slower than it should do. Oh, fuck's sake.
But I think we're all.
Sake.
I think we've reached a point where we're all getting a bit spiky with. I think everyone was a bit like, you know, you're annoyed about missing sound check. I'm annoyed about.
No, man. What happens in those situations, as you know, is that me and Tim go into deliriously post-colonial jolly mode. And we're like, no, it's jolly fine. Everything's going to be jolly wonderful. What a lovely view. What a lovely car. Yeah, what a lovely bus.
Partly because we know how annoying you'll find it, Guy.
Yeah, exactly. It'll irritate the hell out of me. But then I remember Rachel, in the midst of everybody getting seriously grouchy around her, she spotted some weeds growing between the metal barrier between the size of the motorway. Yeah. Do you remember? And she pointed out the flowers. She said, look at those flowers. Look how cute they are. They're absolutely beautiful. Yeah, but it was impossible not to go. I mean, you know, anyone else, I'd have wanted to go, fucking flowers, we late for fucking weeds and the fucking side of, you know, I'd have gone apeshit. But when this, she's such
it's
a
so
lovely
true.
Spirit that when this person says to you, look at that, I actually think to myself, she's 100% right. Look at that.
Yeah,
you know, it was great. And I think that influence really helped.
Okay, well, I remember that guy next time that we're late for check-in. Flying to the Ukraine. I'll be
look
like,
at the flowers,
just look
guy.
At,
look
just
at
look
their
at
flowers.
The flowers on the
it's
runway.
It's not going to work.
Just calm down, man.
It won't have the same effect coming from you. It won't have the same effect.
Guy, what was the thing? Guy, what was the thing about the window? Because that was one of the only times you've ever had a bus where the bunks.
I've never had a bus where windows open.
And Guy,
we had the world's cheapest bus.
You called it something, and wasn't it Rachel called it one thing, the window, and you called it another thing because that was the window out of which you looked to determine what sort of day it was going to be.
Yeah,
like if it was going to be grey and miserable. And didn't you call it something like the? I can't remember.
It's probably the window into men's souls, but it was like that was really tough for us because that was our first bus, single decker Crosslands, and each bunk had a window. that you could jam open, which we learned, we later learned that that's completely wrong and no buses should ever have a window because everything gets really damp or some rubbish like that.
Yeah.
But for some reason, Crosslands had drilled all these windows into all the bunks, which was lovely because in the morning you could open and get some fresh air if you were traveling. God, it was great. Or you get some white noise. And often in the bunk, when you, when you're in the bunk and, you, and you've stopped and you want to check where you are, what time it is, what's going on, you can't tell because it's completely blacked out. You're in a black coffin. There's no windows. There's no light. You've no idea whether it's a sunny day or a rainy day or a day or night or anything like that. So to have a little window is such a luxury. I mean, we've never had one since. And I remember on the next run, we asked, oh, can we have a bus with windows? And they were just like, what are you talking about?
There's no such thing.
There's no, they don't exist.
Actually, I think that bus did have a room at the back with an actual skylight that you could open. So that we did have a smoking lounge on the actual first ever bus. It was at the back of,
we could open it, but then we had a replacement driver who tonked it on the way into Milan, but you lot were all asleep.
That's right. We needed to bear
I was awake for some reason, and he got lost. He got off because I was smoking in the driver's cab at the time, and he got lost. The sat nav took him. He wasn't using a, he was using a normal sat nav, and we were going down this road by the river, and the bridges were getting lower and lower and lower, and I was like getting a bit freaked out. And then on the final bridge, it just basically knocked the skylight down permanently.
I remember that,
Man, it was really scary.
Actually, you mentioned John, our driver, on that one. I think this was the PD tour was the one where he went the wrong way up a road in like Marseille, and Marseille is an unforgiving town for a nightliner. If you've gone the wrong road, you could
Getting a bus up there is forever.
You could be in a bit
of trouble. I mean, it's impossible. I don't know how they
Do you remember he had to reverse down a road, and there was no ifs or buts. He had to reverse down this road. It was a long way. He had to reverse 100 metres. All the cars were just going to have to cooperate with him. It was just a nightmare. Absolute nightmare. And I remember there's times when you're reversing a nightline or whatever. Do you remember, gents, where we all agree, just don't look. You can look out the road and you realise the street sign is literally an inch away from the bus, and he's manoeuvring around it. And you think, don't look. It's too scary. But I remember looking out, and there was this French guy stood. It was an old fella. And he was the absolute stereotypical Frenchman. Honestly, man, he was one step away from stripy jumper and a string of onions. I mean, it was wonderful.
You sounded so Boris Johnson.
Sorry about that. But it's true. He was very, very, and our driver was very stereotypically English. So the two of them, was a situation where
they don't even speak the bloody lingo.
Exactly. So, and John was reversing this thing, and this old fellow was stood there watching this incident, and he had this look on his face of being puzzled as to what the hell this driver was doing. And I remember watching this, and John had to get out to actually assess this corner. So he stops the bus, climbs out of his cab, jumps down, and this bloke stood there looking at him with his arms folded. And I thought, okay, they're about to have a fight, these two. This is going to kick off.
Yeah.
And John looks at him, and he's angry already because he's having to do this stupid maneuver. And he goes, what? And this old chap said to him, I can't do the French accent, so I'm not going to. He said, that was the best bit of driving I have ever seen anybody do. And John faded it. She went, oh, thank you very much. It was so sweet. It was absolutely amazing. Yeah, it was great. The two of them were firm friends.
So that was the Perfect Darkness tour. All shapes and sizes happened on that tour, didn't it? It was just great. All the venues and
everything was a first, pretty much.
I think after that tour, when we got to the last show in Massey, and we got some great pictures out of it, we just felt like that, okay, that's what a tour should feel like. Instead of it lasting for 2 years and being a week here, a week there, a weekend here, a week there, that's everywhere in like 6 weeks. That's it. We just did it. And I think after that moment, we were like, right, that's what we do from now on.
Sure, definitely. But it was a learning curve. And I remember several points during the tour, we were offered lots of stuff for the following year. And I mean, this is sort of probably a place to finish on before we go into chapter six. But we were offered a few things. They essentially wanted us to do the same thing again. And we were all a bit kind of nervous about it because I suppose we were kind of thinking, right, well, what are we going to do next year? What's it going to be like? Are we going to have any money? All sorts of things. Are we going to want to go away for this amount of time, or do we want to crack back into some songwriting? I think that I was going to ask you guys how you think you might have felt when the year finished, because I remember feeling that, okay, I've had an amazing experience, but I was a little bit uncertain for the future. I wasn't feeling quite as optimistic as perhaps I might
That's
have done.
That's interesting, really. I mean,
I was the opposite.
Because I guess we hadn't had the, I mean, the RCO thing, which obviously we'll talk about in chapter six, that the impact and the actual scale and even anything about it hadn't really hit home, that was going to sort of define the following year. So the next year looked a bit sort of murky.
It did. And I think one of the things that you're talking about is when they say you're going to go do the same tour to the same people in the same venues again. That's like, I don't really see how that's progressing at all.
Yeah, yeah.
And sometimes in the smoky back rooms of the music business where the cigars get put out in giant ashtrays, they talk about, you know, sending the right message. You know,
sure.
You can't play that venue because it sends the message that you're not. ... or you should play this venue because it sends the message that ... And I just think we were in such uncharted territory. We didn't know what our message was anymore. It was more like, you know, well, I think when I got back from that tour, I remember my main thought, having to really go through the memory files, was next year we're playing some really funky places. So how are we going to do this tour without this stuff?
Yeah.
So how are we going to play Perfect Darkness in some of the places where we're not going to have a bus and a light rig and projections and a lighting guy? And how are we going to represent this? So the Europeans are going to get the full show. Everywhere else in the world is going to get a kind of the same show as we had before, just with new music.
Yeah, that's right.
I think, just to be honest, I just remember thinking that what just happened was my main thought, because it's like, we sold a ton of merch. The record had done really great. The press was awesome. We'd just finished a bus tour. I just felt that we were actually now a thing, like, for real.
Yeah.
I know I keep saying that on these podcasts because that's it isn't until it is. It's just a continuous,
yeah.
Oh, my God, this is a thing now, you know. But
sure, yeah.
I just remember thinking, okay, from now on, it's a bus thing. And the bus costs this, which means the venues have to be this, which means we have to be this. And it's all interconnected. It's like an upward spiral.
Yeah. What about you, Guy? Do you remember at all how you might have felt at the end of the year?
To be honest, I was remarkably upbeat. But, you know, for me, that's a surprise. And also for it to be relative to you two. I felt, you know, in Spinal Tap way, this is it. This is it.
We're
on our way now.
Yeah, no, I felt the tour had gone so well that I was nothing but positive. What were we looking at? Was it summer festivals? Is that the following year? Was it like we're doing summer festivals?
No, we were looking at Christmas when we got back from that tour, and then we were looking at the following year.
So just rinse and repeat.
Bit of Germany, some big gig in the mix that Summit's been talking about, and a bit more of this and a little bit of that and a bit of a victory lap over here.
Yeah, I think
the summer festivals hadn't come in yet, and I don't think the victory lap had been booked yet.
If anything, I was probably being a bit naive at that point. I probably thought, well, from here on in, it's just going to be a massive
champagne
bowl of cherries,
roses, baby.
I thought,
champagne,
you know,
and roses.
Yeah, that's it. I think I probably was of a mind of, well, nothing can possibly be a setback now. Which in some ways I was right, and in other ways, maybe not. You know,
I mean, the only other thing I should mention about Perfect Darkness maybe is the fact that once you've recorded an album in a fancy studio in LA and gone on tour in a bus, it's very difficult to go back to recording an album in your loft and doing a tour in a self-driven splitter.
Yeah.
So from now on, Summit's edict of we're going to do things differently, well, we've discovered what the new normal was. So it's like, whatever happens next, we have to, as a live act, we have to be that good to be this band. To write new music, has to be good enough to be this band, you know?
Yeah.
If we want to go from single decker to double decker, we need our music to go from C-list to B-list, you know? We have to you know,
up the
in
ante.
The most positive and natural way, step up.
Yeah, absolutely.
And to acknowledge, as you said, we hadn't yet brought in any extra musicians, and maybe that was a very good way of compensating. Yeah, I think maybe festivals come into our mind because you're thinking, okay, so we're not going to get to set up Lamposaurus on this stage. They don't have time for it. So how are we going to do it? We're on a bigger stage, more pressure. We've got to fulfill the obligation of being as good as we just were, but without Lamposaurus to lean on. So that brings us to the next chapter, doesn't it, really?
Yeah, definitely.
What are we going to do, and how are we going to do it?
How are we going to do it? Well, on that note.
On that note, good night. Thanks for listening,
everybody.
Thanks for casting our pod in your ears.